Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. As always, I ask you guys, my supporters, to support this show financially in proportion of what you've gotten from it and what you've learned from it. I don't like asking for money, but my financial situation forces it, and I ask you to give what you can. My website, RusJournal.org, has a way to do that, and I really appreciate it. And those who have given already, I thank you very much. Today, I'm going to talk about something a bit drier than normal, but it's one of the most significant and important issues in the world, and that's the politics of natural gas between Russia and Europe. This is, you know, economics is the root cause of most international issues. It's not to say that everything is economic and that this is a, you know, economic determinist ideology, but it is today. You're dealing with conglomerates in these fields and in most fields now, and so the market is completely irrelevant. Political power matters, and these oligarchical institutions, these conglomerates, create markets. They don't respond to them. But the gas crisis between Russia and Ukraine was one of the levers by which the West came and took over much of the economy. The price of oil and gas is one of the essential markers for the future of the Western economy. And as fuel prices go down, profits will go up. And so the battle between Ukraine and Russia, which is still being fought in the Stockholm arbitration court since 2014, while it might not be the most exciting thing in the world, is absolutely essential for understanding what's happening in the world. This isn't something you're going to hear on, you know, presidential debates or anything, and yet this is the hard core of what you have to know if you want to understand politics there. But I do want to stress that the extractive industries, oil and gas in Russia, account for less than 10% of its GDP. It's a large percent of its exports, however. But it's false to say that Russia is dependent on oil and gas. It's simply not true. Now, as far as Ukraine is concerned, about half of its about half of Russia's exports to the country up until 2014 were oil and gas. Ukraine now has shifted to the West, as you might expect, since the coup of that year. And now they're paying about 20% more than they would have with Russia. But really, since the fall of the USSR, the gas war has been going on. Once Viktor Yanukovych was kicked out, the new government was rejected in the Far East. And this war, which has calmed down but is still going on, has substantial legal and economic consequences. The gas crisis is fairly simple. Russia is one of the largest suppliers of natural gas in the world and has pipelines linking it to Ukraine and from there to the rest of Europe. Ukraine is dependent on Russian gas, as is most of Europe, especially Germany. But the Ukrainian economy imploded in the 1990s, and so the debt that Ukraine owed to Russia grew substantially. At the same time, the infrastructure administration declined pretty substantially, and Ukrainian transport became riskier as it was loaded with official corruption. As it stands, as of last year, Ukraine owes Gazprom, which is a Russian gas company, this sort of semi-private, semi-public company, about $5 billion. And once Ukraine became an enemy of Russia officially, The Russian response was to say, okay, now you guys are going to pay market price rather than the subsidized price that Ukraine had enjoyed prior to that. If you believe so much in the free market, well, you'll pay market prices then. But even there, now prices have gone down substantially. But having shifted mostly to the West, Ukraine is paying more. Ukraine is an absolute disaster. And I've said this numerous times. It's one of the great tragedies of the 1990s and the 2000s, is that what should be one of the economic powerhouses of the world is now essentially fourth world. Her goods are not well regarded in Europe, other than immigration and raw materials, really. Europe accounted maybe 25% of all Ukrainian exports. It's increased a little bit, but maybe that's only for a political reason. But companies that export to Europe are foreign-owned but operate in Ukraine. And so sometimes it's really hard to tell if it's a Ukrainian company or not. But since 2012, commodity exports from Ukraine to the EU fell by almost 10%. And they also fell relative to Russia. And it just reflects a general collapse of all the production potential in the area. You have aging equipment, irrational economic policies, rapid capital depreciation. Ukraine is simply not competitive in Europe. And its capital depreciation in this field and all other fields, actually, is about three times higher than that in Europe. And the energy bills now gaining interest is making matters worse. And Ukrainian engineering, especially today, and Western engineering are two very, very different things. So the overthrow of Yanukovych and the attempt to bring Ukraine into the EU guarantees her nothing more than third world status. It will be an extreme periphery of the EU and will only really deal with raw materials and girls for Western elites. Right now, it's selling mostly raw materials and some agricultural products, some metals. This is the overwhelming bulk of exports. But Western farmers don't want any of these agricultural materials from Ukraine. The prices are low enough in Europe. But Ukrainian metalworks rely on Russian imports, intermediate goods, by about 40%. So Ukraine as an independent nation has always been a bit of a strange thing, because she is so dependent on Russia. And wherever she goes, wherever she leans, dependency is going to be a fact of life. It made sense for her to go into the customs union, into Eurasia, where she would, she then would have a chance. She would be respected in her specialization in electronics and things, which she'd done in the Soviet Union, would be taken seriously. In the West, unfortunately, it's not. And that's really the situation as it stands now. The implosion of the Ukrainian economy is a central issue here. And you really can't deal with Russia-Ukrainian relations, which are absolutely essential, and may be the source of an American war there. Whenever you ask about the massive buildup of American forces on Russia's border, Ukraine often comes up as the reason why, and they'll say that Russia somehow invaded eastern Ukraine to support the rebels in Donetsk. And yet, it's the only invasion that no one's ever noticed. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The invasion story was invented by the Ukrainian high command to cover over their absolute, not just incompetence, but cowardice. And they were defeated so badly, and many of them ran from battle, that by the time they got back to Kiev, having lost many men, and they essentially lost that civil war, they needed a scapegoat. And so they invented this Russian invasion. Again, the only invasion that no one's ever noticed in the history of the world. But when the liberal oligarchs came to power in 2014, the West bought up a lot of Ukraine's gas. And that also means, to some extent, they bought up Ukraine's debt. And so whatever happens, you know, as gas prices rise, Ukraine comes under great pressure. And then the hryvnia, the currency there, really has no value whatsoever. And the decline in domestic demand is massive. And when the currency is not stable, when the economy is not stable, no one is going to be no one's going to be very interested in investing in the country. There's been a tremendous number of violations of the contract between Russia and Ukraine concerning natural gas. And so Gazprom, which is the Russian side, filed a lawsuit in Stockholm. And Kiev was accusing them of monopoly price setting. But the Russians were concerned with this uninterrupted flow of gas to Europe, which is absolutely essential, not just to the Russian economy, but to Europe as well. And sanctions have slowed this, but have not stopped it. But in Ukraine, the lack of money, the lack of transparency, the lack of infrastructure, this is, you know, this was Ukraine's last stand, was to sue Russia. It was a way to avoid paying. And Vladimir Putin is a conciliator, is a conciliator here. And he's willing to accept the arbitration of the court. And the price of gas have been determined in the past by a previous agreement. The market never has anything to do with this. Except more recently, where the Russians have simply said that you're going to pay market price. Now CNBC, several years ago, after the coup in 2014, said that Russia has increased the price of oil, the price of gas by 80%. What they didn't bother to mention is that this increase is just the elimination of subsidies and massive inflation in Ukraine. So it wasn't a great increase, but inflation certainly makes it seem a lot more expensive. So the head of Gazprom, says that the debt of Naftogaz, which is the Ukrainian gas company, stands at roughly about $5 billion and has been building up interest for some time. Moscow was willing to discount this debt by roughly $100 per cubic meter. Per 1,000 cubic meters. And she's even willing to set up emergency plans for repayment. As it stands now, Ukraine is not going to have enough gas for the winter. Now, this is the case quite often. I mean, Ukraine has power outages. You know, it's like North Korea. The prime minister says that the price that Ukraine pays must be the same as everybody else. Since Ukraine is not a part of the Eurasian market, she's not subject to its strictures and therefore has to pay a regular market price. And Kiev is consistently saying that if we don't get a positive judgment from the Stockholm court, which chances are is probably not going to be an objective one, that they're not going to pay for a penny of this. Russia has always been loath to cut off gas, partially because this is the way that gas is getting to Europe, and partially because they don't want Slavs freezing in the wintertime. And yet interest continually piles up. So to roughly say June of 2014, Ukraine imported about 2 billion cubic meters of gas, which increased the debt to what it is now, you know, $5 or $6 billion. So there's about 11.5 billion cubic meters of gas that remains totally unpaid. What Russia did then is demand upfront payment because the currency has no value and will collapse, probably has collapsed. Its value exists because the U.S. government says it does, and foreign aid is really what's propping it up. So it's very rational for them to demand the payment upfront because tomorrow there may be no economy at all. And the risk of dealing with Ukrainian, not only Ukrainian politicians, but Ukrainian infrastructure is tremendous. You know, Russian infrastructure has improved greatly over the last, you know, since 2010. But essentially what Ukraine is doing is demanding that Russia sell gas at a loss. And it remains completely untenable. Ukraine's claim can only be based on the idea that the West will back her demands, even at the risk of avoiding every possible international regulation and contracts. So the natural gas issue is about international law, is about international economics, and is about the foundation of the coming war with Russia. It's a monopoly oligarchical institution wherever it goes, because it's so massively capital intensive it has to pretty much be a monopoly wherever it's created. You have to have billions of dollars to enter into that market for obvious reasons. And yet the situation now doesn't serve anyone's interest. There is no predictable legal environment in Ukraine. And Russia is very willing to turn off the switch. And Kyiv will finally have to bear the brunt of its own policies. But WTO law is going to be violated if that's the case. The only rational purpose here for Ukraine trying to sue Moscow, apart from simply not wanting to pay the billions of dollars that it can't possibly pay, it's based on the idea that the U.S. and its allies will build its own infrastructure serving most of Europe. And so, while that's largely completed, they avoided paying Russia, and then if they switch to the West, which they have, then they don't have to pay at all. And it's not just, a capital-intensive industry. It requires an army of expert technicians. And in Ukraine, it's a colossal sum to get its infrastructure back to working order. So it's not just capital-intensive in the respect of building a new structure to remove it from Russian dependency. It's also to revive the Ukrainian infrastructure is an equal amount. But that is nothing compared to what Ukraine needs on a regular basis. So Kyiv has to deal with Gazprom as a customer, and it has its contractual obligations. And her present insolence is based really on the fact that for the moment, Western powers are backing Kyiv for strictly political reasons. Naftogaz was instructed in January to stop sending Russian gas into Europe. That increased the absurdity of Ukraine's position, and it just rendered Kyiv even more insolvent than it had been before. Ukraine won't follow any contract that it simply can't obey. Ukraine has no legal or economic case, even if one accepts that the idea that the EU has any right to decide Russian policy, but the EU is not planning on rejecting its completely crippled client. So it's a clear breach of contract, and it's based on not only a decaying infrastructure and intense corruption, but Russia has maintained normal gas flows as a gesture of goodwill for the sake of not allowing the country to freeze. Kyiv is at the moment really overplaying its hand. Any penny that goes into Ukraine right now, they're never going to see again. This extremely corrupt and irrational economy is non-transparent, essentially non-functional, and Western-owned. The point of the coup in 2014 was that Ukrainian oligarchs were saddled with debt that it couldn't pay. A nationalist Ukrainian government would refuse this, because the idea was to simply trade sovereignty for debt relief. For Ukraine to shift its production to EU demand, which is ridiculous to begin with, it would cost her billions upon billions of dollars. Joining the EU would cost her even more, because the infrastructure in terms of economic policy and the legal environment has to become parallel to Europe's, which in no way is not even close. Now, the EU has thrown the rulebook out the window by bringing in Romania and Bulgaria, so it may do the same for Ukraine solely for political reasons, to make sure that she never goes back to supporting Russia, although pro-Russian sentiment is always great in Ukraine. Even in the West, it's just under 50%. But the EU can't force Russia to turn the switch back on if they ever turned it off. And Russia doesn't have much incentive. There's simply no money in Kyiv. Nothing about Ukraine's position right now is in her interest. Nothing about Ukrainian's position is doing anything to reassure investors or foreign banks. Ukrainian goods are not needed in the EU. But you add to this by deliberately permitting the sale of what little she does have is stunning. What Ukraine has to offer, of course, is a Russian foundation. It's the only source of hard currency that the country has. Kyiv's reaction to all of this has been to complain that Russia is using its strategic resources and the power of its champion, Gazprom, as a political weapon. And the fact is that the present government in Kyiv has no legal or moral right to exist, let alone pass judgment on something like this. And this is absolutely essential to understand. For those of you who don't know, and I've been talking about this on this show for a very long time, the Ukrainian economy since 1991 has been a disaster like no other. There's no other example in history of an economy collapsing this rapidly without warfare. The same thing goes for Russia in the 1990s. It collapsed of its own weight, but it also collapsed because oligarchs had no interest in investing in it. These oligarchs were Jewish and internationalist, and they were shipping what capital was functioning off to bank accounts in Geneva and New York. Hyperinflation was the norm in the 1990s, and GDP was falling something like 10% a year in the first 5 years of the 1990s. 1990s, Ukraine lost half its total GDP. And what the liberal oligarchs were doing was selling off capital to keep creditors at bay. There's mass unemployment, and the only way that Ukraine functions right now is through the black market. So during the Soviet era, you know, Moscow provided subsidized gas to Ukraine. Once the USSR fell, there was no more obligation there. But Moscow, both under Yeltsin and Putin, maintained artificially low prices for a long time. It was simply goodwill. But it hasn't helped the Ukrainian economy, though. Corruption, oligarchy, and capital equipment aging rapidly are really the cause of its meltdown. Russia has been looking east to China and India in her attempt to reshape the global market. You know, Eurasianism is, as an economic area, it contains complementary economies. It's both rational and defensible. Ukraine, however, it sought support from Western powers, including the EU and the USA. It doesn't mean that the population at large seeks salvation from the EU, nor does it mean that Ukraine is anti-Russian. It just means that the group who seized power in 2014 is looking for aid, trade, and recognition from Western power centers. Russia was demanding radical reform of the Ukrainian economy, and the West was willing to turn a blind eye, like it has done in Ukraine and Bulgaria, if it turned on Russia. In fact, if a country turns on Russia, it will get away with anything. And that's the main issue. Any hope that Ukraine can become anything other than a raw materials exporter to the EU is simply a pipe dream. Westernization is the same thing as deindustrialization. Everything, any profit-making industries in Ukraine are located in the East, not under Kiev's control, but they require inputs from Russia to function at all. I said this before, but the Ukrainian economy was shaped under the Soviet Union as a piece of a larger empire. That meant when it declared independence in 91, it was not an independent country. It couldn't be. Its economy was completely distorted in a sense, in that it wasn't national. It was an element in a much larger all-Soviet body. So to shift that from being a piece of the Soviet Union to being independent hasn't been done. Rather than make that shift, it's collapsed entirely. Belarus, on the other hand, has, because through strong political leadership and state control over exports and state control over investment and targeted investment like you had in South Korea and Japan, rescued the country from what happened to Ukraine. Belarus is really a shining light in that area. It's the wealthiest country in the former Soviet bloc. It has the highest level of equality, has the highest standards of health and well-being in the former Eastern Bloc. And the only way it was able to do this is simply by kicking the IMF out. And this is why Alexander Lukashenko, who is a social nationalist, I've written on him substantially, is demonized by the West entirely. Now, Lukoil is one of these national champions for Russia. Lukoil is, you know, because oil and gas are so essential to Russian exports. It does have some state control. It's mostly a private entity, though. But it does have some residual forms of public control. The corporation is almost exclusively private in terms of ownership, but the state does play a large role in the firm's board of directors. But when you say it's a national champion, it means that it reflects this public-private world where private investors can profit from things, but at the same time they're expected to act in the interests of the state. And the state is meant to use its own power to buttress the fortunes of the firm. Since Russia's exports have a strong basis in oil and other extraction industries like gas, it has to be able to control at least the basic decision-making of a company like Lukoil. And 22% of the world's crude oil comes from Lukoil. And for Russia herself, about 90% of its own crude comes from there. So the significance of this firm to the Russian state can't be understated. It's considered off-limits to foreign investors. The reason why Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was arrested early on in I think it was 2004, was that he was on his way to sell Lukoil and other parts of his extractive empire to ExxonMobil. He was arrested, dragged from his limousine on the way to signing the firm over. There is no question that Putin was justified there. Now, it's true he hadn't paid taxes in 20 years. That was the pretext, but that wasn't really the reason. The main reason was that he was going to destroy Russian sovereignty this way. So the point of Russian or state control over a company like this, not state ownership, but state control, is to make sure that it's not bought by foreign elements. Now, because of the sanctions, which is the best thing that ever happened to Russia, that would be impossible. But at the time, it was not. Its existence now is one of the most strategic elements of the state and the broader Russian economy. In fact, of China, Belarus, and Georgia, and Ukraine as well. The fact that it ships so much oil into China from Siberia makes it a global player, almost like a country in and of itself. And it's gone through a period of tremendous reform, contrary to what's being talked about in the West, where some of her old inefficiencies and some of its old Soviet-era capital depreciation has been changed. It functions no differently than any other large firm, but this is of such national significance that its transparency really concerns the control of by the state. And the U.S. government is always accusing Lukoil of being corrupt, and what it comes down to is that they're working in the interest of the Russian state rather than the interests of the West. That's the definition of corruption in Western circles. Now, you don't hear politicians talking about this. It's too dry of a topic, and it's too technical of a topic. But they do talk about it in subcommittee hearings. Republican neocons are financed heavily by oil firms who quite rightly see Russia as their main challenge, and it's most certainly true. Every major neocon Republican has big oil running the show. The prices of any of the extractive industries are so essential to any, the American economy is hopeless now, but they don't know that. And by securing cheaper and cheaper forms of energy, whatever chance the West and the U.S. has to recover is increased. And so, you're not going to hear about this in the West, but Lukoil has really, even with the state control, has capped a lot of its inefficient wells, has expanded into natural gas, because it already has this massive pipeline network. And there is a limited international investment. Iran, China, and Burma are three areas of development here. And Burma and Iran are known for their oil reserves. And so Lukoil is a big part of the Eurasian economy and is a big part of this organization against the New World Order or the liberal West. And this is the essential issue. And of course, transport, is really the artery. This is the main capital part of the infrastructure of any company like this. And it has its own police force, which is essentially Russia's border police. And they have an anti-terror squad that can move from place to place because of how significant the pipelines are. When the Chechen War broke out, one of the first things they did, and it showed how that they were a part of, they were supplied by the U.S., that they would attack Russian pipelines, even though it hurt their own economy to do so. The company spends a fortune on both private security as well as taxes to maintain this, the border police, which acts as its anti-terrorism squad. But, you know, her near abroad markets, Belarus and Ukraine, have been nothing but a problem for it. They've been charged with monopoly and strong arm tactics and things like this. And both countries, for a long time, are dependent on Lukoil. It is true that Belarus, although pro-Russian though it is, it did see an interruption in oil flows due to a pricing conflict not too long ago. But for the moment, Ukraine is an ally for the West and is really pushing for other firms to develop alternative transportation systems. Politics and oil, of course, go hand in hand. This is America's foreign policy, is almost entirely controlled by the extractive industries. But in terms of its general reputation with investors, Lukoil has an excellent reputation. Now, there are some people who claim that Ukraine has about 14 billion cubic meters of gas in an underground storage facility. It's unclear if this belongs to Ukraine or Gazprom. I don't know the proof about this. I think it does exist. Because what the Ukrainian government's been doing since, 1991 is siphoning off gas from the main pipelines and putting it into their own private store to resell it later. And it's because of this that these lawsuits came into being and that Russia demanded a prepayment, which of course was condemned in the West and is one of the many reasons for the sanctions that exist now. But the U.S. and the EU are claiming that they have sovereignty over who Russia sells gas to and at what price. There's no country in the world that would permit the price of its most strategic resource to be set by an international arbiter. But Ukraine's economy is a disaster. It's high risk, antiquated equipment, and a history of skimming gas. And this is why Russia is very wary of doing anything that doesn't include payment in advance. And especially since the hryvnia could disappear tomorrow. Now, as some of you know, China and Russia have agreed to dump the dollar this year. The banking infrastructure for that has been completed. This is proof that Putin has nationalized the Russian central bank. In no way, if there were any Western interests in the central bank of the Russian Federation, would they accept this policy. But they have 100%. So that's your strong evidence that while it might not be owned by the Russian state, it certainly is controlled by it. And a lot of this has to do with the sanctions. The sanctions forced Russia to become self-sufficient in all of these areas. It really made me smile when I found out that, I think some of you know, that Russia has been banned from the SWIFT system, which is the means of processing credit card purchases globally. It's a Western system, and Russia's banned from it. So they started their own. And China is a major investor in it, and Iran is part of it, and everything else. And I read, in Russian, I read the list of companies that do business with it. And I see American Express and Citibank. That was not exactly announced in the West. And they're violating sanctions in order to do that. And if that's not proof that these companies have absolutely no faith in the American economy, then nothing will convince you. They can violate sanctions because a lawsuit, the federal government would have to bring a lawsuit against them for doing this. It would be long. It would be extremely costly. And the U.S. doesn't have the guts for this. And so I think both Citibank and American Express, who, you know, Citibank especially is one of the financiers of the American government, is free to do as it pleases. The American Express finances quite a bit of the left globally, so it has a lot of power that way. But even if sanctions were to be enforced on these two companies, it would be very, very expensive. And there's not a whole lot of politicians that would go for it, given the power that Citibank has over the American economy, over the American budget. Now, despite the sanctions that exist on the Russian economy, Ukraine's position is completely opposed to the WTO. Because what they've done, and this is by early summer of 2014, Yatsenyuk, who's no longer prime minister, he announced the start of preparations for the establishment of an international firm that will become the main transport operator of the new gas system. Of course, the controlling stake is Ukrainian oligarchs, but no more than 49% will be allotted to foreign oligarchs. Russia is banned from having any stake whatsoever, which in and of itself is completely opposed to all WTO legal norms. And antics like this couldn't be any more prejudicial or provocative to Russia and add more fuel, so to speak, to the conflict. And Ukraine has reneged on numerous obligations to act as a transit state for Russian gas in Europe. Ukraine is just in a very poor economic and legal shape here. And their only concern is to do what Albania does. They can get away with all of this stuff if they promise to be as anti-Russian as possible and to serve as a staging area for American attacks on Russia. The assumption is if we continue to tell the Americans that Russia is going to invade Europe at any time, which they have said many times, that Russia has invaded Eastern Ukraine, is going to invade Europe, is going to invade the Baltics. They're planning on doing it. We know that they're going to do it. But they'll scare the Americans enough that they won't have to pay these bills because they have the EU and the US militarily behind them. Now, crying wolf, you know, 5 years ago was one thing, but no one's buying it anymore. The checks haven't been, I mean, you know, the IMF and you know, the World Bank and private companies, well, I'm sorry, the World Bank and the IMF are private companies. They're just a consortium. That's just a front. But they have floated tremendous both loans and grants to the Ukrainian government. But any loan is also a grant. And you would think that some of this money would be used to pay off the gas debt, and none of it has. So it's in terrible conditions and condition in that respect. But its sole standing is in trying to frighten the West that there is this Russian invasion due at any moment, and so you have to back what we want. Now, it shouldn't really need to be said that refusing to pay a debt that goes back so far is a breach of contract. The Ukrainian government, Ukrainian oligarchic Naftogaz firm, has been in breach of international law in this respect, developed by the West, while it's trying to support the West and trying to become a part of the European Union. And it's conceivable that Western sanctions were a way that Ukraine could avoid paying this. Because Ukraine wants to be a part of this and it tries, it's, you know, it's almost impossible that they could actually take the sanctions seriously. Because even if most of Ukraine is foreign-owned, they still require Russian inputs. But such a blatant breach of contract can't stand for long. The WTO provides a forum, really, that gives incentives for completely insolvent countries to come to terms with their creditors. It's known as rebalancing. And it states any breach of contract can be met with the total cessation of trade over that issue. So in other words, if a country is totally insolvent and can't pay its debts for a certain good to another country, that other country may turn off the switch entirely. That's right in the WTO documents. So there is no obligation for Russia under international law to do anything else but turn off the switch and permit Ukraine to deal with the fallout. Even more, the WTO permits Russia to demand damages as a result. And Russia has every right, therefore, to take punitive action against Ukraine until a settlement is reached. There was a case that the Russians cited from 1999 where the U.S. was cited as being in breach with Ecuador over banana imports. And the court said this: one may ask whether this objective of inducing compliance may ever be achieved in a situation where a great imbalance in terms of trade volume and economic power exists between the complaining party seeking suspension and the other party which has failed to bring WTO inconsistent measures into compliance with WTO law. In such a case, and in situations where the complaining party is highly dependent on imports from the other, it may happen that the suspension entails more harmful effects for the party seeking suspension than for the other party. End quote. Now that's certainly just, and it gives Russia the right to turn off the switch. The fact that Kiev is now a client state of Washington, it doesn't apply anymore. Ukraine alone would be able to cite this as a means of moderating Gazprom's view. But given Ukraine's allies, it's not an issue anymore. Ecuador has a huge portion of its exports tied up in fruit, so Ecuador received the benefit of the doubt there. But the dispute settlement understanding, which is a separate document from WTO, it says that if one case is brought by a developing country that's a member, in considering what appropriate action might be taken, the WTO itself will take into account not only the trade coverage of measures that's the subject of complaint, but also their impact on the economy of the developing nation. Yet this also can be applied to Russia. Obviously, gas is significant to Ukraine, but it's also 50% of Ukraine's imports from Russia. So it doesn't provide a standard, since the two countries are politically and economically equal under the present circumstances, at least as far as oil and gas are concerned. They're not equal economically speaking, but they both have a mutual dependence on one another in terms of oil and gas. There's no question that the effect of Gazprom's measures would be devastating, but it's very, very hard to blame Russia for the problem. So the WTO on this case makes several things clear. The world trade regime, regardless of origin, states that to suspend deliveries of a product from the supplier to the offending customer, the point was to induce compliance. That's perfectly legitimate, and that's what Russia is threatening to do, and has been threatening to do for some years. The West says it can't do this, and threatens them, and threatens war with them, is one of the reasons that there are sanctions, one of the reasons that people like John McCain are threatening war with the Russian Federation. European models of international law added a moral dimension, holding that, not unreasonably, that any retaliation needs to be equivalent to the nature of the breach. In other words, Gazprom is certainly justified in taking the action against the insolvent and crippled Ukraine, but there is the question of equivalency that requires several variables to be weighed, including the history of Russian subsidies and the condition of the Ukrainian economy. Russian goodwill in continuing to negotiate with Kiev has to be taken into account, especially after it was clear that they were an enemy of Russia, and ignoring the history of Ukrainian theft of Russian gas. But so is the impact on Kiev, as well as on Gazprom and Russian exports in general. So the conclusion here is that WTO rules and similar bodies have a great degree of flexibility in terms of breach of contract issues. As a rule, resorting to the WTO dispute settlement system is open to members whose trade has suffered, even in potential terms, from the violation of WTO obligations. Article 3 introduces a presumption that violations of WTO obligations cause nullification or impairment of benefits of the members. The respondent can challenge such a presumption. If the challenge is successful, then adjudication is precluded. And this is especially true in Russia's case. It's true in real terms of currency and loss, but also in terms of a long history of subsidized fuel and a great degree of interdependence. Russia's case is far more solid than Ukraine's. So countermeasures have to be proportionate to the nullification of the benefits of the complainant. WTO obligations are treated as indivisible. The effects of the violation are immaterial, and the complainant may have suffered no adverse effects at all. So legal issues in this dispute are not really mysterious. Russian resources and European dependency are facts of life. Russian exploitation of comparative advantage is normal, rational, and ethical under the circumstances. Kiev's attempt to justify every conceivable way of breaching contracts is neither ethical nor rational. Being an enemy of Russia, Moscow's options are far more diverse. The Russian legal framework over its most powerful and significant advantage is not amenable to open markets in the Western sense. To demand such as to open the floodgates for American and European gas and oil firms that would take over Russian energy and therefore take over the Russian economy, at least in terms of exports. If sovereignty is the bedrock of international law, and it is, then Russia is under no ethical or legal obligation to relinquish its protection over its resources and comparative advantage. Ukraine, however, remains in a very powerful position as 80% of Russian gas to Europe travels through that route, so-called Brotherhood Pipeline. To build an alternative route would more than double the average cost of the pipeline, and so the option is usually avoided. Russia has, however, decided to build an alternative route to bypass all transit sites and problems associated with them. The Nord Stream will deliver Russian gas directly to Western Europe. Until this is it came online in 2010, Russia is going to need to continue finding ways to ensure uninterrupted and timely supplies of contracted gas to reach Europe in the future. So the problem that Brussels and Kiev have with Russian policy, the West has created alternative pipelines that sacrifice the efficiency in favor of the geopolitical desire to harm Russia. Transit states, especially Ukraine, are problematic because first, they're far more influenced by the West than Russia herself. And second, the infrastructure and political problems of Ukraine make transit a risky business at the best of times. So Russia has every reason to abandon the Brotherhood line, except that Moscow still has an interest to break Kiev's irrational attachment to Brussels and Washington. Rather than using this to their advantage, Kiev is going to absurd lengths to cover up its most comic insolvency through threats, rhetoric, and self-justification. In Moscow, Moscow and Kiev have operated this way through written agreements. In fact, in the 2012 contract signed by Kiev, says what the obligations are for both parties. Safety concerns can lead to a shutdown of all deliveries. If terms are violated, then Russia has every contractual right to stop or reduce the flow of oil and gas to Ukraine. Moscow is not subject to international arbitration relative to a contract. That's been the norm for Kiev for some time. It's only in her bankrupt position that she is demanding some redress that doesn't involve her economic health. So, I know a lot of that has been quite technical, but this is the nature of international politics, like it or not. The U.S. is planning war with Russia. I've been saying this since the late 90s. I've also been saying since the early 90s, and I was the only one saying this, that Russia is going to be the bedrock fighter against the New World Order, and therefore the Orthodox Church is going to be the religion of rebellion. You know, I've been saying this even before Bill Clinton was elected. And only recently have other people finally jumped on board. And now Putin has become what I predicted he would become many years ago. And has shown himself to be a social nationalist in general. But being a politician, rather than someone who's in a position to be just a pure ideologue, he has to work with the system as it stands. He has to work within the WTO, but the WTO works in Russia's favor for a lot of reasons. Right now, Ukraine is in total breach of contract. But Russia could even turn off the gas for Ukraine just because the infrastructure is so bad. That's their 2012 contract. Ukraine is in no position to demand that Russia continue to submit. Essentially, what they're doing is they're demanding that they use the threat of Western military intervention to lower the prices of Russian gas. And yet, Russia continues to permit the flow of gas, knowing it's not going to get a lot of this money. And that's because, number one, it doesn't want to sell to Europe. And number two, it will not permit Ukrainians to freeze. Because they can't buy coal from the east, where most of it is mined, They're bringing in coal from South Africa, of all places. In other words, they're doing the most inefficient, nonsensical things to fight Russia. Their economy is in no position for this kind of nonsense. So, you know, just a few years ago, the EU set up a loan package of 250 million euros and another 500 million in two different tranches, so to speak. But rather than enter into negotiation with Gazprom, Kiev has declared a state of emergency and rationing policies for the gas presently in the country. The EU has now to face a shortage of gas for its own needs, which can only increase the price for alternative supplies. And given Ukraine's long history of gas theft, underground storage is depleted or possibly not even existent. But when the cold hits, the question is going to become more intense. There are regional monopolies in this field, monstrous investment, bringing Caspian countries to the oil and gas through the territory of Russia could be a means of maintaining influence in the region, but the Caspian region now is mostly part of the Eurasian market, meaning that they qualify for lower gas prices. Ukraine, when a part of the USSR, and even to the present decade, received subsidized gas. Those decades of preferential treatment should be considered as part of the debt. The debt would be much higher than it already is. It could be $10 billion, could be $15 billion. One of the reasons that Crimea is in such excellent economic shape is that she saw her gas prices fall tremendously. Becoming a part of Russia means that she's a part of the Eurasian Union, which means she qualifies for preferential trade with Russia and China, and now China is rebuilding her infrastructure. Because she's now on the ruble rather than the hryvnia, their bank accounts, while not changing in amounts, have doubled in value, tripled in value. And now people are willing to work. Because when you have a country like Ukraine, what is the point of working? You don't know if any fruits of your labor are ever going to be found. Lukoil has an impressive profile. Under state control, because of state control, its transparency is tremendous. She's reforming her basic processes, horizontal integration of all of her assets. And the U.S. is in no position, given that it has no transparency for its corporate bodies, to condemn them. And they're deepening their alliances with Central Asia and China. Well, reinvestment of profits, rather than giving dividends, is the fruits of state influence. Their profits are high, but it usually goes into infrastructure improvements. They don't give dividends on stock. But any free trade between Kiev and the EU has to be partly based on the idea that in order to punish Russia, the West will buy Ukrainian goods, regardless of the fact that they're all made domestically. Any belief that the free trade deal between two partners of radically unequal development would be beneficial to Kiev has no empirical foundation. There's simply no way. The Ukrainian economy can't function without Russia. There's a massive brain drain from the country. No one trusts the infrastructure in all respects, legal as well as in terms of the pipelines and other things. And the huge amount of investment in trade with Moscow will be stopped. Ukraine's exports are partly Russian, or mostly Russian, the entire concept is an economic contradiction. Ukraine can't be separated from Russia. And this is what happened in 2014. The oligarchs simply sold off Ukraine for debt relief. Some of you know, unfortunately, this happened under Yanukovych, that Chevron and Shell simply bought large chunks of Ukrainian territory. Chevron bought the West, and Shell bought the East. These companies had constitutional police powers. They weren't just investments. They bought the country. They had their own private armies and private police forces. And local governments, of course, were up in arms over this, since the interest was fracking, which meant a massive drain on Ukraine's water supplies. The contracts were that these two companies had total 100% free access to all of Ukraine's water, no matter where it was. The only real positive benefit of the coup in 2014 is that these two companies had to flee. And it's a huge negative on Yanukovych's record, but unfortunately he inherited a disastrous economy, and they were willing to spend billions of dollars to have this power. Chevron, of course, was, Shell was kicked out of the East anyway. But because no one really trusts the system, I mean, the only reason they were willing to buy it in the first place was that they trusted Yanukovych far more than anybody else. Even if Ukraine was a part of the customs union, they would have remained. I mentioned the Citibank signing up for the new Russian credit card system, secretly. Now, if you don't know Russian, you don't know that, because it's not something that they announced, and it's technically illegal. Shows that they're willing to work with the customs union for the sake of their own profits. They certainly don't trust Ukraine, and they don't trust their own countries. The West can't recover, because recovery would be based on consumption, and Western consumers can't consume anymore. There is simply no more credit left. The private sector debt is $12 trillion right now. And that's not including future obligations. Public sector debt, as we well know, is about $17 trillion. Put those two together, they're not enough dollars on the planet in 100 years to pay that debt off. The number one aspect of the number one chunk of the American budget is debt service. That's just going to get larger. U.S. is either going to have to somehow repudiate that debt, which, because U.S. is totally controlled by private forces, is unlikely, or simply going to go into economic collapse. Now, when Russia and China dumped the dollar, because now both countries have a nationalized central bank, that's going to make even greater pressure, because now you're going to have billions of dollars just sitting around with nothing to do. China will then dump a lot of its dollars, as will Russia, because they were buying dollars in order to use them for oil and gas trading. If it's going to be done in the Chinese currency, which is the proposal, it's already been agreed to by all parties, and this is also in the case for Central Asia, the huge countries of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, and Iran is part of this as well. You're talking about a huge amount of trade. And also, I should say, India is a part of this. The U.S. is finished. The dollar will be non-existent. Therefore, the only choice is war with Russia, a war that it can't win. Russia and China have a defense alliance that's always been kept under wraps, because the American public can't be made aware of this. This is the only time that I can think of that there's been a massive military buildup for no public reason. This issue between Russia and Ukraine over oil and gas has been the closest they've ever come to any kind of a reason. This belief that Russia is going to invade Europe was concocted by Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk before. Of course, has absolutely no foundation in reality. But if they're going to believe that Russia somehow invaded eastern Ukraine, an invasion that no one saw or noticed, then they'll believe anything. As I said, that invasion story was concocted by the Ukrainian military. Several of its generals simply abandoned their posts because they were humiliated by the militias of eastern Ukraine. These are national socialist countries, Luhansk and Donetsk, and they make that very clear. They're nationalists in their economic policies. Their domestic policies and their socialist and their economic policies. And the main focus is that international trade is in state hands, and their national champions, stuff like coal and oil, will always be in state hands. It has to be that way. Because if these are bought up, as they were in Ukraine 10 years ago, by foreigners, there'll be nothing left of the country. Their sovereignty will be completely destroyed. And of course, that's the point. And this is why you have such massive investment lobbying investment in politicians. Oil and gas are the concern for the regime right now. And that's why I had to get into some of the technical issues between Russia and Ukraine here, and the fact that even by the West's own rules, Russia's in the right. And Ukrainian government certainly has no right to exist. That's not accepted by the Ukrainian population, not even by Ukrainian nationalists anymore, because it's an internationalist liberal government. It has nothing to do with anybody. It represents nobody but oligarchs. That they're functioning on the assumption that the U.S. will always come to their rescue, and therefore they could be as reckless as they want, is outrageous for Ukraine as well as for the U.S. But I can't think of another example where American forces are, you know, poised for attack, and no one has given a reason. And why are American soldiers going to die for nothing? Well, best bet for them is to turn their guns in the other direction. They're not going to die for oil oligarchs. The Ukrainian army, as some of you know, fell apart mostly through desertion. They weren't going to fight for oligarchs. They weren't going to kill other Ukrainians. And they deserted. But they went home. They went to Russia. And therefore, the U.S. taxpayer and the European taxpayer is paying for mercenaries to continue the war with Novorossiya. That's the world that we live in. No American soldier is going to die for oligarchs and for oil, for benefits they're never going to see. And if they do, they deserve the coward's burial that they're going to get. Anyway, thank you for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.